buried in your body, the beautiful place. The moment that you find it, you try to escape. Back to the comfort of now, the blanket of lead. Out in the hopes between the brain and the bed, maybe with the sum of all we embrace. I know, nothing will be left but our beautiful place. I know, ooh, in our beautiful place. I know. Coffin, another cocoon, colorful clouds begging to bloom into a picture of you, but it isn't your face, and only a few try to describe what's in the beautiful. Maybe with the sum of all we embrace. I know, nothing will be left but our beautiful place. I know, every time we kiss, it's all, it's all, it's all I can taste. I know, everybody's hearing now and now. Our beautiful place. I know it. In our beautiful place. I know it. Only laughing 'cause beauty does ugly things to selfish people. Baby, with the sum of all we embrace. I know, nothing will be left but our beautiful place. I know, every time we kiss, it's all, it's all I can taste. I know, everybody's here in our, our beautiful. I know it. Ooh, in our beautiful place. I know it.
And that was the song Beautiful Place. And I'm here today with writer, director, actor, comedian, songwriter, Stuart Davis.
So,
woo, that's
I'm not good
stuff.
At all those things.
One doesn't matter.
One at a time at most.
Stuart has released 14 albums, and he's had his own television series, which we'll find out more about here in a minute. And a Stuart Davis performance typically combines original songs, comedy sketches, and monologues. He'll be performing at the Blue Sage Center for the Arts this Friday, that's tomorrow, from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Welcome to Talkin' Music, Stuart.
Hi, how are you? Talk and music.
Yeah. along with the show tomorrow, there's going to be an exhibit at the gallery at the Blue Sage of your crow paintings.
Yeah, I paint and have for years. It's kind of this peculiar hobby that I have. I love to paint, but I only paint crows, and I do it in a constructed language. There's a language that I created called Is. It's kind of a thought experiment, and the plumage of the crows, the body of the crows, is rendered in this text from this. It's hard to describe verbally, yeah, but it makes sense when you see it immediately. It's like if you step back, it just looks like a kind of calligraphy rendering of a crow. But then when you look closely, you see that the poems in this language are encrypted into the body of the birds. So it's a way that I simultaneously work on the language and paint crows. I'm a Zen practitioner, so I'm sort of into crows symbolically, and also just literally love them as living creatures on the planet.
Crows are good. What? Why? I didn't know about their significance in Zen.
Yeah, they have a presence and a standing. They have a very interesting role because they occupy this unmade, the black dimension of them, sort of referring to the esoteric component of Zen, the inscrutable enigma of the unanswerable riddle of whatever you're engaging in Zen is. And I'm not a Zen master, I'm just a student, but I have been for like 15 years or so. And I've always loved crows and what they embody in Zen, which is this living riddle with a sense of humor that simultaneously straddles both the esoteric and the exoteric dimensions of the spiritual path and spiritual inquiry. And I love that sense of humor and the trickster component that's kind of in there and the intelligence, but they tend to symbolize something that won't yield itself or lend itself to merely cognitive or cerebral apprehension. So they're always pushing you into a more creative, trans-intellectual kind of state. So that's why I've fixated on them as subjects in my paintings. And painting is definitely not my day job by any means. But it's something that I love, and the paintings are fun to bring along to something. So they'll be at the show too.
And so your Buddhist studies, is that what brought you to Boulder? Because I know originally you're from Minneapolis, right?
Yeah, exactly. It certainly didn't hurt because Boulder is kind of the Buddhist capital of the United States in some ways, thanks to Trungpa and the whole Vajrayana lineage that, with Naropa being there and him kind of setting up a little Tibet. But as a Zen practitioner, my roots are more in the Japanese lineages. And there were three Zen centers that were very active in Minneapolis when I left there. My wife is a Vajrayana Buddhist practitioner. She went to Naropa and stuff. So that's kind of like the Catholicism, Lutheranism combo in the Buddhist version. So we have a sparky but wonderful relationship in that way. Yeah. I love being in Boulder for that reason. You don't feel that it's weird to be Buddhist in Boulder.
No, it's almost weird not to be.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's different than being in Houston. Nothing against Houston, but it's not quite as seamless.
No. So I read one of your blogs. You have a great website, and you do a lot of stuff, like the whole writer, director, actor, comedian, songwriter thing. That's you've got a lot going on, as well as a blog. And you said that Minneapolis is that wonderful world where the weather tried to kill you and the neighbors tried to save you.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I like that. So tell me about growing up there. How did you develop your, all your varied interests?
Well, that's really true about that state. The weather is incredibly dangerous. And I didn't realize this until I left and came to live in Boulder. But from blizzards to ice storms to floods and floods that would freeze, tornadoes, lightning, hail, just everything you can think of all the time. But I was so used to it and immersed in it that I'd never noticed it. And especially driving for a living, I would, typically would do 100 to 150 shows a year, all based out of Minneapolis. And so for 10 or 15 years, I was constantly driving from Minneapolis to somewhere. And every season, I can't believe I didn't die. I got in lots of really, really dangerous situations with the weather. So I developed a kind of, I guess checkered relationship, emotional relationship with the weather there, because it really did scare the life out of me a few times. And once I left, I realized it's crazy to live there. Why did I ever live there? Why did I do that? It was just so immediately Boulder, sunshine, the beautiful mountains, all the good stuff of snow and the seasons with none of the continual unremitting assault on my health and well-being and safety. So There was that part. And then the part of being saved is also true, which is I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian family in the suburbs of Minneapolis. And I went to church and was immersed in a very aggressive kind of Christianity that I still am processing and making peace with. And I know it goes both ways. I know that I was hard on my Christian tribe as well. And it's never been easy for my mom and dad had a rough time figuring out how to integrate me into the spiritual system of our family. So, and they did a great job, to their credit. But yeah, it was very much a, you know, this is the truth. And if you don't believe it, big trouble. Mm-hmm. And there's one way, and that's the right way and the true way. I mean, all the things that we typically see with many varieties of religion around the world. So, and you know, Buddhism is certainly not immune to that either, in more subtle and exotic ways maybe. But so yeah, I was always the weather was trying to kill me and the neighbors were trying to save me.
And how did you get involved in all the various art forms there?
Well, that's an interesting arc, because really it's been music as my day job for, you know, I started touring full-time when I was like 21 years old, and I'm 42 now, so it's been more than a couple decades. And this, I think, was my 14th album that I just put out. So that's been stable. About 5 years ago, I got a book deal, and so I ended up writing a couple books, which was just a very fluky, weird, random thing. And only happened because a friend of mine who's a famous author pretty much strong-armed a publisher into giving me a book deal. You
that's
know?
How it gets done.
Yeah, and then I got a TV show by just completely bluffing my way. I went into a production meeting with a TV company, and I said, I want to make this show. It's called Sex God Rock and Roll. I know how to make a TV show. This is what it's going to... It was a complete bluff. I had no idea how to make a TV show. I didn't think I was going to sell it. I just was kind of winging it in the meeting, and I got a green light. And so then we had to make a TV show, and I actually learned to make a TV show while I was doing it, which I do not recommend at all. It's a miracle I didn't screw up the first season so badly that it couldn't go to broadcast. But I got lucky because my crew saved me every time I didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, and I was the director and the writer and the host and the producer and a creator. And I really was not qualified to do it. And I learned from my crew.
Yeah, I don't think very many people are qualified.
That was my philosophy. That really, I mean, truly, that was my philosophy, though, because I was like, listen, I think all of us have these moments where we're like, I could do that. You know, yeah. How hard could it be? You write a thing, you da-da-da. That was my attitude. And I went into the pitch meeting like that. And when they said yes, and I made season one, I realized a lot. Yeah. I really learned a lot. And I realized, oh, man, I can't do that again. I have to, you know. So season two, also, it was ridiculous that we got a television network, because I made the season of season one before I had a network to broadcast it. So I finished all the episodes and then was like, I guess I have to go find a television network now to broadcast this. And I called Mark Cuban, first person I contacted, and he said yes and put it on his network, HDNet, which is now Access TV. And that also was a complete fluke. Never happens, has never happened again. I've been in 24 pitch meetings since then. I've never sold a show. I've never been able to get another network to pick something up. It was a complete fluke. So then we made season one, and we didn't get canceled. We made season two, where I might make season three. I'm hoping to do a different show, possibly. That stuff's in the wings. But yeah, I mean, we just made it up as we went along. It was ridiculous.
How does someone see this show? Can you see it?
Season one and two were on Access, which is cable, basic cable. You can go to sexgodrockandroll.com, and you can see most of every episode on there for free anyway. Some of it's on YouTube. You can watch it on Amazon as well, streaming it.
Oh, wow. So give me a little bit of information about what the show is. Is it a sitcom?
It's like a rock and roll version of The Daily Show. It has skits. I do stand-up. There's a news desk. We cover the ridiculous news from the realms of sex and God and rock and roll. And It's just like The Daily Show or The Colbert Report, except we don't cover any politics, and it's all about sexuality and spirituality. And it's also, I like it because it's not making fun of those subjects. Those are my favorite things in life. I really wanted to make a show that was a comedy but was celebrating, you know, the clumsy odyssey that we're all on in those realms. So that's the basic format, yeah.
And I've been speaking with Stuart Davis. He's in town to do a show over at the Blue Sage Center for the Arts tomorrow night. We'd love to hear another song, Stuart.
Yeah, I'm going to do a new one. I'm going to debut a new song. This is called Pulsing. Pulsing. Silk wall convulsing, pulsing, blue billow and membrane, pursing, seeds unspool, rush the vein.
The song Pulsing from Stuart Davis. So you're moving to Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I forgot. September 1st. I will be an honorary Dutch person.
How did that happen?
I just love Amsterdam. I've toured over there quite a bit. And there's something about, I mean, first of all, it's just kind of a no-brainer because it's so beautiful. The city is so beautiful. And it's really, it appeals to me in the sense of the water that's everywhere. And it's kind of an interesting city because it's pretty calm. I know it has this perception from outside of like the red light district and the hash bars and all of that. But really, it's very neighborhoody and chill. And I've always felt very relaxed when I've been there. So we spent a summer there with my family. I brought them with me on tour in Europe and we stayed there. And we just totally fell in love with it, and everything from not having a car to, you know, the buildings and the sense of history. The Dutch people are fascinating to me because they're very worldly and very intelligent, but they're also, they're kind of pros at being hosts.
Mm-hmm.
They're very non, I don't know how to put it, like they don't interfere, but they're always there and friendly. They kind of have that hosting thing down. I guess it's because they're like a port town for, you know, they rose to prominence and power, I guess, historically from being a world port. Maybe that's part of it. It's just a good fit, and I just wanted to mix it up, and I wanted my daughters to experience a foreign culture.
Cool. It must be exciting. How old are your daughters?
9 and 6.
Oh, that's a good age.
I think so. I think
to make a bold move like that, actually.
It feels right, yeah, because they're not quite into the adolescent grips of, you know, being traumatized by leaving their friends. They're excited about it and very curious. And it's cool now because you can even go on Google Maps and just walk around the neighborhood that we're in virtually, you know, using Google Street View. You can just walk. You can be like, here's where we live. This is the coffee shop we're going to go to. Here's where we have dinner.
We did that with Santa Cruz because we were going to stop in Santa Cruz on this little trip I took with my family. And when we did that, we kind of didn't want to go.
Oh, really? Really? That's interesting. What did you see?
We're like, oh, that doesn't look very good.
What
right
did you
there
see?
On that street corner. I think it was just the hotel we'd booked wasn't in the nicest neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, but we didn't realize that till we took our little walk down Google Lane.
I had the same experience in Santa Cruz where I honestly did. I booked a hotel randomly online and then I got there and realized like, oh, this is not a good situation that I'm in. I had a very romantic idea about Santa Cruz that it was just all hugs and people around fires on a beach, which is preposterous.
It's leftover from the 70s.
Exactly. I thought I was like, I'm going to run into Joni Mitchell. We're going to write a song by bonfire. It's going to be amazing.
It's changed a lot, I think. So it seems like you're always creating something. You seem like a very creative person. And I was wondering if you ever go through dry spells. Or you just
I don't. I think that my struggle is in the other direction, which I can't really claim credit for. I'm just made in this way where stuff is always coming out of me like a fire hose. And sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's really interferes with me being able to do practical things. I've needed to become better at being able to do things like pay bills and keep to a schedule, like get my daughters to school on time, or practical things are a challenge for me, and I've had to enlist a lot of help. Sometimes I get apprehensive about listening to the creative voice because it's just as soon as it knows you're listening, it starts erupting this Vesuvian, you know, unremitting flow of stuff and ideas. And inevitably, the tricky part of that is that it takes a lot of focus and actually practical stick-with-itness to implement something. So the easiest part for sure is the creative part. You can come up with ideas. It's very easy to conceive a screenplay or a TV show, etc. But to make one takes so long.
Like right.
Thinking of the TV show took me an hour. And it took 3 years of our lives and a team of dozens of people and all that to create it and implement it and get it to go. So I realize now as well that creativity, I'm very, very grateful for it, but I also understand that it's important to bring the things to life and to see them to fruition, and that that's a very big commitment and it's a long-term relationship, whether it's an album or a TV show or a screenplay, even a painting. And so I'm a little more selective about which voice in the choir gets to, you know, come to the fore.
Yeah, you can't do all the ideas.
You can't.
Probably.
And you probably shouldn't. I mean, I have a lot of ideas and they're not all good, man. There's really a lot of bad ideas in my head. Because creativity is very indiscriminate.
Yeah.
It doesn't make, this is what's great about it, is that it doesn't make value judgments and it doesn't make a hierarchical rating of its own font of what it issues. But that should still exist. So at some point you have to sit down and go, okay, here's 100 things I thought of. 95 of them are either boring or bad or just, you know, and there's always a handful that are really interesting and have some viability. But the creative voice itself is just very indiscriminate and kind of always on And so you have to filter it.
I find, too, it's hard to explain sometimes to other people what your vision is. And I think I've done some creative projects just simply to illustrate what I was talking about.
Exactly.
The idea. It's like, see, this is what I was getting at.
Exactly.
And people are still like, okay.
That's really true. And that's a whole interesting topic for me, because there's a nonverbal modality of communication that is that we depend upon. Like, for instance, in the studio, when I'm working with producers, it's impossible to verbally convey your vision. And so what I've noticed is that really gifted producers and music artists, or really creative types in any medium, but they have a capacity to, it's not telepathy, it's not like psychic, but they're so in tune with the communication and signaling that's occurring in every part of your being that they can interpret and apprehend your vision non-verbally. And how that occurs is very mysterious, but it's something that I've seen over and over again, where I go in and try to convey to a producer, Alex Gibson, for instance, who's the guy who produced this music, the album that I just finished. And I can't put the words together. There's no way. And he will just use this assembly, this mobile of all of these different signalings from my body language to, you know, a lot of it I think is probably unconscious or super conscious for him. And he can, and then he makes the sounds and gives the sonic body to it that I was trying to express. I have no idea how it happens. It's very mysterious.
It sounds like you found the right producer.
Yeah, I did. I got really lucky and fortunate to have Alex, yeah.
Nice. And I've been speaking with Stuart Davis, and he will be playing at the Blue Sage Center for the Arts this Friday. That's tomorrow from 4:30 to 7. You can also see some of his artwork there. Thanks so much for stopping by, Stuart.
Thank you so much for having me in.
Can we hear one more song?
Oh, yes. I'm going to do one called Good Weird.
Habit of climbing up a trash mound, stripping for a crowd of rowdy adolescents, and a parody of puberty and human evanescence. Weird, good weird, weird, that's weird, what am I feeling? Weird, good weird. I damn near died at the moment of conception. My daddy couldn't keep his erection, but you'd never guess it to see me today, because I stand up straight like a typical gay, with a flock of baby birds that are stuck in my mouth. I want to gag and gag till they come fluttering out. I'm living with lockjaw and eggshell cheeks. I keep dreading the day that they discover their beaks. But you shudder at the thought of a cook or a kitchen. Ever since you were six, you could smell the religions. Boiling out the love into poisonous glue, recruiting the kids like cannibals do.